Well, my name is Caroline Eford, and I am with Vicki Everhart in Meissenheimer, North Carolina, and today is June 26, 2018.
And I am Vicki Everhart, and I'm going to be telling you a little bit about my life.
Well, thank you. Could you start by telling a little bit about your grandparents, if you knew them?
I didn't get to meet my father's parents because his mother died when he was six, and his father died when he was about 12. My mother was actually born in Society Hill, South Carolina, and she was one of four children before her parents separated, divorced, and then had two different families. Her father having nine additional children, and her mother had another eight additional children. So my mother had a very large family that made up for my father not having very many.
Did you spend any time with any of them?
I did get to spend some time with my grandparents down. They both lived just a few miles apart, and my grandfather was a farmer, and so we got to help work in tobacco and working in cotton. So I did get to actually pick some cotton and pick tobacco, and for a sum total of I think 5 cents a day. So, and it was really, really hard work. But it was nice at the end of the day when you got to go back and have a cold drink and a pack of crackers and rest after a hard day's work. And at my grandmother's, we just hung out and chased the chickens. So it really wasn't that much, but there was just always a lot of people around to talk to and tell stories and learn about family history with.
What kinds of things did they tell you about family history?
Just mainly the guys, of course, making street rods and how they would run them up and down the back roads and swimming at the Boy Scout camp, which was just a few miles from there. And when they would go swimming, every so often an alligator would get after them. And one of the campers lost a toe to an alligator. So there was some really, really special stories that they got to share with us.
Did you spend a lot of time there?
Not a lot, because it's about a little over 70 miles from here. And of course we always had our own gardens and everything to come back and take care of here, because we were a self-sustaining family. That my father was a welder, and he traveled all over the United States, and he helped to build the Astrodome. He helped to build a lot of the bridges in Louisiana. He actually helped to build the arch in St. Louis, and he's actually one of the people on one of the videos that they have, the history videos, helping to put one of the last pieces into the arch when they had to weld it in the very last piece of it. But with him always traveling, and of course we were always fixing the garden, canning things, there were seven of us, and so we had to put away a lot of food to make ends meet and to make it through the winter. Because everybody around Stanley County, they didn't tend to have a lot at that time in the 50s and 60s. And so basically you just had to work for what you had.
And how did your parents end up in Stanley County?
That's really a crazy story, because my father was married before. And with him being a traveling welder, his wife ended up pregnant. She didn't want the baby, She tried to get rid of it. The baby died. And she died. And so he went to visit his brother in Society Hill, South Carolina, who was married to my mother's aunt. And she lived in the farmhouse. My mother did it was a dairy farm. And they had like 2,000 head of cow. And so when he came down there to visit, and they just hung out together, and he was going through the mourning period after losing his wife, and with his brother being married to my aunt who lived in the house, they just spent a lot of time together. And she had another boyfriend, and she found out he was running around on her. And my dad said, "I'm telling you what, if you married me, I wouldn't ever run around on you." And he dared her. She went through the dare. They stayed married till the day he died. So, you know, life's sometimes stranger than fiction.
And what year did they get married?
40. That would have been 1940. So. And because my dad was born in 1913 and she was born in 1923. And so there's, you know, an age difference there, but they made it work.
And did they move to Stanley County right after they got married?
They did. He brought his new wife back to the place that he had lived and had a nice house. And so they lived there until my mother decided she couldn't live in the shadow of his former wife. So they built a little house on 5 acres of land, and that's where I was born and raised. I was born in the hospital, but raised there.
Can you tell me a little bit about your childhood growing up there?
I was a tomboy, and my dad had bought my sister and I a couple horses, and I rode bareback around the pasture. And my brother, that's 4 years younger than me, he would jump out from behind a tree with a stick, and the horses would throw me. Sometimes I landed in the pig walla. Sometimes you just got dirty and scratched up. But I was a bit of a tomboy, and any time they wanted to find me, they'd just look in the top of the tallest tree, and that's where they would find me.
What was your experience of school like?
I liked school. I didn't love school, but I did okay. And, of course, when I turned 16, I started driving the school bus, along with starting to take cosmetology out at Indy. And as a matter of fact, the day that I got my license, I wrecked my mother's new car on the way to Indy, and so they bought me a Volkswagen. So the little Volkswagen ran a lot between North Stanley and Indy with the cosmetology classes. But I've always loved fixing hair. After I got through climbing the trees, then just I went on to fixing people's hair.
And were you expected to help out a lot with the garden and the farming and all that?
Oh, definitely. It was a family affair. So you got up with the sun sometimes before, and everybody just grabbed a hoe and. We didn't have a tractor, we actually had a mule. And the mule, you had to hook it up and plow the garden. And then when my dad got horses, he did teach the horse to pull the plow. But life was an experience. I learned to cook, I learned to can, I learned to bake. And all those good things that it takes to grow up to keep a husband happy. Because they like to eat.
What was one of your favorite things to cook?
I normally did a lot of the baking in the house. And so I baked a lot of different cakes. And in home economics at school, I learned to make biscuits. And I was the A1 biscuit maker. But of course, my mother, she liked to make the biscuits. But I would slip in sometimes and get them made before she got back in there. So then we got to eat my biscuits however I decided to make them. And since they teach you to make them out of a lot of different things, once in a while she would get mayonnaise biscuits, then again she would get butter biscuits. But they were biscuits.
And what did it mean when you were growing up to be healthy in your family?
To be able to do the things that you needed to do, to work a full day, go to school a full day, just to be able to take care of yourself, be self-sufficient.
Do you have any memories of going to the doctor when you were a child?
My main memories, I had being a tomboy, I had quite a few accidents. And when I was 5 years old, I was standing beside of my dad in his 52 Pontiac, and he hit a tree, and my head went inside the glove box. And so I spent many, many months in the hospital, and I still have a scar, and it cracked my skull and all of that, and the sinuses, and so I've had a lot of sinus problems and ear infections throughout the years. So I had quite a few doctor visits. The rest of my family, not so much. But with mine, one little story about when my head was so messed up is they were taking me in for a special kind of an x-ray. And it just happened to be the time of the year that we were making kraut. So you'd take the cabbage and you'd chop, chop, chop. And my older sister told me that when I went in, that she wanted to go ahead and tell me goodbye and give me a kiss, because when I went in and that machine came down, it was just going to go chop, 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 chop like the kraut. So I jumped down and I ran and I hit my head and I burst it back open. And so they had to send me back into the operating room to have stitches all over again. So that's what happens when you have older sisters and brothers.
And how did your family, do you know how they paid for medical care?
I think it all just came out of the pocket, because I don't think back during that time that we had any type of insurances until later, in the later years, maybe even in the early 60s, until we started getting the insurance.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you did after you graduated from North Stanley?
Well, when I graduated from North Stanley that summer, I was the Richfield Mice and Hammer Beauty Queen. So I got to be in the parade out at Oakboro and at Albemarle and all of the surrounding towns where they go out and they show off their best. And it was just quite an honor to be able to do that. And then I just started working my first, well, I had actually always worked babysitting and or at restaurants, but I actually started working at a used car lot as a receptionist. And I was actually good at selling cars. Because when people would come in and they would talk to me about the things, I'd start talking about the cars and they would buy the cars. So I was a natural salesman.
And what did you do after that?
Well, after that, I ended up getting back together with a friend of mine that I had dated several times, and we started going out, and then we decided to get married, and I ended up moving to Guam. And I lived in the Pacific Ocean in Guam for a year. And then I got pregnant with my first son and ended up moving back to Stanley County for a few months until after he was born. And then we left from Stanley County and went to Germany for 4 years. and that's where my daughter was born. And as I was saying before, I had come home on vacation. I came home for vacation around July, and that's when I ended up. They thought that I had had a miscarriage, and I was in Presbyterian Hospital, and they were going to go ahead and do a DNC and everything, and my older sister helped to smuggle me out of the hospital because I didn't think that my baby was gone. But yet I had passed a fetus. And so my mother had signed papers saying that I was not just real right in the head, because I kept telling them they couldn't do surgery because I didn't feel that my baby was gone. And that was in July, and my little blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl was born on December the 13th, on Friday the 13th of that year. So I did the right thing, and my sister did the right thing. And my mother could never do enough for my daughter, because she felt that she almost ended her life before it ever got a chance to start. And so she was her favorite out of 12 grandchildren. And my son was her only grandson. So he was her favorite for that.
Did your children spend a lot of time with her or their grandparents?
When I moved back, we came back from Germany, and because I went back to Germany, and that's where she was born after I almost lost her here. And we moved to Maryland for 3 years, and I worked at the National Security Agency while I was up there. And then I decided that I was just going to move back to Stanley County, because we kind of grew apart, my husband and I, and so I moved back to Stanley County and we got a divorce. And my daughter just seemed to think that, of course, her grandmother loved her more than anybody else, and so she just wanted to stay with her all the time. So we made one of my mother's spare rooms into her room, even though she had a room at home. But she stayed about as much with my mother as she did with me, because it was only 3 miles between houses. And it was really funny, because if she was not with my mother would drive up in the yard and she would run out and jump in the car. And she would wait, and my mother would say, "She's in the car again." I'm going, "Well, you shouldn't have stopped. You knew she was going to go." And so she would go and stay, and every so often I would pick her up and bring her home with her screaming and hollering, but she did stay with me, you know, quite a bit, but she really liked staying with her grandmother.
And how did you support yourself when you moved back to Stanley County?
When I moved back, I actually, oh my goodness, I started working at Pat and Mick's Fish House, and I helped out there, and I also worked at the florist with Poplin's Florist during the day. And after a while, I decided that I just had to be me, and so I opened a dairy bar in Richfield. And so I ran Vicky's Deli and Dairy for 2 years. And I had the first video games in Richfield, and all the kids would come and have their birthday parties. And Lanny just worked down the street, and so he would come over and help me out at the dairy bar. And so it just was one of those things. He hung out there and helped me so much. We became closer friends, and then we got married.
And what year was that?
That was in 1984. And we're still married today.
Can you tell me any about what the two of you would do during your early friendship or dating relationship?
Normally work in my yard. I would plant flowers, he would dig holes, plant bushes, and he helped me out, you know, around the dairy bar. And it's just one of those things. I really had no intentions of getting married again. But every time I turned around, he was saying, "Why don't we get married?" And I'm like, "No." And then finally, one day, I was so tired of saying no, I said, "Okay, let's just do it." And so we did. We had a small wedding out at Richfield Baptist. And just had friends, close friends and family that came to the wedding. And of course, my two kids, Jarrett and Carrie, they were there. And they were really happy to have him as their stepdad. And Jarrett says that had I not married Lanny, that he wouldn't have had a dad to show him how to do things, because he showed him how to work on vehicles and just all things about being a guy. And the real main reason why I finally told Lanny that I would marry him is because I accidentally walked in on my son in the bathroom one day. He was in the tub and he was using my razor to shave his legs because he just thought that's what people did. And I explained to him, guys don't shave their legs. And he said, "Well, you never told me that." And I decided he needed more of a male influence in his life. So, and as he got older, he only dated women who had kids. And we asked him, was that a prerequisite? You know, that you, a person's got to have kids for you to date them. And he said, "No, but it helps." He said, "Because if Lanny hadn't have married you, I wouldn't have had a dad." So it's, life goes around. And of course, my daughter also, she, the first guy that she met that had a little boy, and he was a few years, Alex was a few years younger than she was, but he and his girlfriend had a baby when he was 16. And when the baby was 18 months old, he and Carrie met each other, and she fell in love with the baby, and they got married. And so they're still married. And they have one daughter, Raceland Elizabeth. And they've lived down in Charleston, and she's a registered nurse, and he is an English teacher. And I mean, they went on and both of them finished their college education and did great.
And do you still get to see Jarrett?
Jarrett only lives 3 miles from here. He worked with us for 14 years after he did 2 years in the military. And then he wanted to go out on his own, because in the trucking industry, you know, guys think that if they're not doing it by themselves. And so after 14 years, he bought his own truck. And so he's doing a little bit different, but still working in the trucking industry.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you and Lanny got into the trucking industry?
Lanny went to college, to Piedmont, to be a diesel mechanic and welder. And it's kind of crazy, but my dad died the year that I moved back to Stanley County. The place Rand Construction was right next door to where my mom and dad lived, because they had moved off the farm and moved out to Richfield in a little brick house out there. And when my dad died, Lanny got his job. Because when he had stopped welding, he had got hurt real bad in a welding accident, came back to Stanley County, and Luther Behringer had given him a job overseeing their shop, doing their welding, working on the trucks, and just basically their shop foreman. And when he passed away, then they gave Lanny the job. And that's how he and I ended up talking, and you know, it was just amazing that he was so much like my dad. He did all the things that my dad did. And I guess that's why we ended up together.
And how did you end up starting your business?
With him working on trucks and heavy equipment, and just a few weeks before we were supposed to get married, his job, they ran construction, lays pipe for sewer pipes, water pipes, and they were going to do a big job in Durham, and they wanted him to move to Durham, and he was going to be there 7 days a week for weeks at a time, and he told them he couldn't, that he was getting married, not to move to Durham, that I had the dairy bar, and he was working next door, and that was great, but he could not move to Durham. And so he, when he wouldn't move up there, they told him, well, they would have to let him go. And he had been with them for quite a few years at that time. And they just loved him dearly. He just fit into their family. And so with them letting him go under those circumstances, the owner of the company, he kept signing stuff where he couldn't draw unemployment. And so Lanny took him to the workman's comp thing to try to draw, not workman's comp, but to the EEOC to try to draw unemployment. And they said, yes, he could draw the unemployment because he was hired to work in Richfield, and that's where he was supposed to be. And just because they wanted him to move to Durham didn't mean he had to move to Durham. And so he got to draw his unemployment, but then he didn't have a job. And he had never drawn unemployment before. And so I had a cousin who was in trucking, and he drove my cousin's truck for 2 weeks. And he said, and then we got married, and he said, you know what, if I'm going to drive a truck, I'm going to drive my own truck. And I said, well, I have $5,000. If we can buy a truck for $5,000, we'll do it. If we can't, we won't. We found a truck that was parked in a cow pasture. And the guy wanted $5,000 for it. And so we pulled it out of the cow pasture, and we brought it home, and we worked on it for several weeks. And we would go out and we'd run 1 week, and we'd bring it back in and take the money that we made and work on the truck until we got it to where we could actually get out and run decent. And then from that, we bought another truck. And that was in late 84, and we've been in trucking ever since. And we actually went on to, instead of just running our own truck, we worked as an agent for another company. And we did that for about 5 years. And they more or less changed their policy. And we were hiring trucks for them, and I would hire like an average of 52 trucks a year. I could hire truck drivers, people with their trucks, because I mean, I was good at selling cars, and so I was good at hiring on trucks. And they loved the fact that we could hire trucks and we could move freight. And we were actually their highest agent, and we won all the awards. We won troops to Aruba, different trips to the Caribbean. And after winning all of the prizes for like 3 years, and they started changing the things that I was telling the drivers, they weren't doing those things anymore. And one day, a driver drove down from West Virginia, and he's waiting on me to tell him all these wonderful things about this company that we were working with. And I opened my mouth, and it came out, if you're going to have anything, hear anything good about them today, you're going to have to call them on the phone, because I haven't got anything good I can say. And Lanny almost died, because we were on the top of the list. I mean, we were the top agents. We had the top revenue. And all of a sudden, I just told somebody that I wasn't doing it anymore. And so he asked him to wait outside. We talked about it a little bit, and I told myself, I can't do that anymore because I feel like I'm ruining other people's lives because if I tell them this company's going to do this and they don't do that. Because all my life, if you can't be true to yourself, and even though I'm telling them what the company's telling me to tell them, if I don't feel like that's the truth, then I'm not being true to myself. So we quit that day and started from scratch again. And we just started our own company. And there was quite a few of the trucks that I had hired for this other company that decided that they felt like I always told them the truth. And so they came and worked with us. And so we ran our own business for 24 years. And it just with all the changes and the way trucking is. And we during that time, we actually started our own brokerage. So we were actually brokering, and we had over 2,000 different companies that called us, you know, wanting us to move their trucks. And we had just hundreds and hundreds of customers that we moved freight with. And it just, with adopting Logan and Christina, things just got to be, you just didn't have any time for anything. And so we started backing back down. And we backed back down to where we're just running a couple trucks, and or we went back with the company who we left almost 25 years by this time again. And they welcomed us back with open arms, and so we're working as agents with them and still running a few of our own trucks. And we gave up the brokerage several years ago due to regulations because of the changes and everything in trucking.
Do you think, what do you think instilled in you that desire to be truthful?
Well, I can tell you just really quickly because my dad, when I was really little, he was raising some hunting dogs. And the hunting dogs, one of the mother dogs was up under the house and had pups. And he told us, he said, I'm trying to train the dogs. Don't feed them anything. I give them food for snacks and I feed them what they need to have. And he caught me one day. I had took the bologna out of the meat drawer, and I was under there feeding bologna to the dogs. And he sat me down on his lap, and I was probably somewhere between 4 and a half, maybe 5 years old, and he said, did you just feed bologna to the dogs? I said, no. And he said, well, and he had a little pamphlet he always kept in his pocket and a pen, and he pulled it out, and he said, well, he said, I really think you did feed the dogs bologna, and you really shouldn't lie. And he said, but here's what happens. When you lie, you need to write it down. Because if you go back and somebody asked you that same question again, you might not remember exactly what you told them. So you've got to write it down. And I just cried, and I said, but I can't write. I don't know how to write. And he said, well, then you shouldn't lie. He said, because if you tell the truth, you'll be true to yourself, and if somebody asked you again tomorrow or next week, you'll know what to tell them. Because it's the truth, where if it's a lie, you have to go back and look it up. And so that's what I've always felt, that the truth is what it is. And if I lie, my face turns bright red.
You also mentioned adopting two children. Could you tell me a little more about that?
We adopted Logan and Christina the year that the towers fell. We were in the midst of doing our paperwork, as a matter of fact, when the towers fell. Lanny had always wanted to adopt because we had raised my two kids, and he felt like even though he was their dad, he didn't feel like he was a father because they still had their birth father who would come into their life and take them to Carol Winn's. He would take them to all the fun places because anytime we would plan a vacation, he popped up and ended up taking them somewhere. So we never got to have those special times. And he just felt like he had missed out. And so for probably 10 years, we had talked about adopting. And our next door neighbor popped up one day and told us that she was going to Russia and she was going to adopt this little blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy. And when I asked her how and why, and she told me this story about how she had gone to the laundromat out at Pfeiffer College and that there was a magazine there. And she sat there looking at it while she was washing this big comforter. And that she opened it up and it said, had a picture of this little blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy that said he was in bad need of a home and that if you could give your love and blah, blah, blah. And she and her husband had talked about adopting. And so she laid the magazine down, forgot about it, went home. A few days later, she told him about it. She went back to get the magazine after she had told him about it, and she couldn't find it. And she looked all over the laundromat. And when she was giving up and walking out the door, this magazine just kind of blew off on the floor and opened up to the page of this little blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy. 18 months later, they brought him home. So Lanny and I, we just kept talking about that. And he said, you know, we could do that. And I would say, okay. And every time I'd start to check on him, he'd say, well, maybe we shouldn't. Maybe we're too old. And I'd say, okay. And then he'd say, well, maybe we should. And finally I said, you know what? Proverbially, crap or get off the pot. You know, you're either going to do it or you're not. And this is the last time. If you want to, we'll check into it. If you don't ever mention it again, because I had always wanted four children. And I almost had three. I ended up losing the one, so I had two. And I figured we'd probably adopt two. And he said, no, we want one little boy. And I said, no, if we do it, let's get two. And he's like, nope, we'll do it, but we'll get one little boy. The day that I was finishing up all the paperwork, and I was just felt so dejected because I had seen this little girl who looked just like my oldest sister who had died 10 years earlier in a car accident. And it just looked just like her when she was little. And I kept saying, but just look at this little girl, you know, we raised two the first time. And just as I was going to hit the last note to finish up the paperwork for the one little boy, the phone rang and he said, okay, if you want the girl, then get the girl. Just like, you know, you want chocolate, you want vanilla, just go ahead, get both. And so I just didn't hesitate. And I filled out all the information, and we were on our way to go get a little boy and a little girl. Unfortunately, the little boy turned out that he had paperwork that didn't work out, and so we had to make a choice 2 weeks prior to going, and we made our second choice, and that was Logan, and he ended up being just very, very sick when we got there. But the main thing is that when we were getting all of our paperwork together and they said, okay, if you've had a divorce or whatever, or, you know, if your ex died, you either have to have a death certificate, divorce certificate, whatever. And so when we pulled out ours, of course, I knew I had been married on June 12th. And when I looked at Logan's paperwork, when we had to make the second choice, his birthday was June the 12th. And then with Christina's, we put notes up all over the house with their pictures, and I had her birth date, which was June the 17th, on her picture, where I could always look at it. And when I pulled out his divorce decree, he had gotten married on June 17th. So Logan was born on the date of my original marriage, and Christina was born on the date of his original marriage. And we were going to get him a little boy and me a little girl. And when we got there, she immediately threw her arms around him, and he had a little girl, and I had a little boy. And it's been that way ever since. But Logan was, he was very, very sick. When we got there, he had a temperature of 104. And he had very little hair. And he had had numerous operations. And when I looked at him, all I could see was just a beautiful little boy. And where he was standing when they brought him to him, I swear it looked like a crown. Just the way the sun was coming through. And I just kept saying, he's beautiful. And later, Lanny told me that when he grabbed my hand, he was hoping that I would jump out the window with him and we would run, because he realized that he was so sick and we were really getting into something he felt like might be over our heads. But 40 surgeries later, and we're still, he's still a beautiful boy. And Christina is in her, she's just finished her second year at Fiverr College. And she's only had her wisdom teeth taken out and one cavity. And a Wilson's fracture on one finger. And other than that, she is in perfect health and so smart. She's been straight A honor roll from pre-K. All the way up, she's on the dean's list. She's does all kinds of community service. We had told her that due to the fact of us having to spend out, even though we had insurance, we had to spend out so much on Logan's, the co-pays, and where the insurance wouldn't pay. And even though the community came together and worked as hard as they did, that anything that we would have saved for a college education, it just wasn't there. And so she worked really hard, and she got enough scholarships to completely pay for her to go to Fiverr. And she's continuing to get scholarships because she wants to go on to Fiverr's, I think it's the nurse practitioner course that they're building in Albemarle. And so she wants to go on and take that and then come back and work in Stanley County. And because of, I think it's because of her being associated with all of Logan's problems. And there was a time he had a feeding tube for 3.5 years. He was so, so sick at one point in time. We actually spent from June through March in the hospital. We were 2 months in Presbyterian, and you know, we were in like 18 days home two, then back in for the rest of the month, and then straight on to UNC at Chapel Hill. And we were there from early August through March, and we'd get out for maybe a day and he would get deathly ill and we'd have to go back. And they finally found that it was in January, they found a blockage in his duodenum because it wouldn't show up on x-ray because it was totally blocked. And so they actually went in and done surgery, opened up the duodenal area. But at this time, they had just given him up just numerous times, just, and told me that they had done everything that they could. And my answer was always the same: no, you haven't. He's still breathing. And so they would try something else. And so then one of the pediatric surgeon, she just took a leap of faith because they kept canceling his surgery because he was so bad. And then one day she said, okay, we're going to do this. And she took him in for surgery. And the next month they transferred her to Tennessee. Not positive it's because she did his surgery, but I feel like it is, because they really didn't think that he would make it, but he did. And his when they cut into his duodenum, it burst, and he ended up with peritonitis, and they had to go back and lace him together. And even after we couldn't, the insurance wouldn't pay for us to be in the hospital anymore. Lanny and I had to learn how to debride his intestines. And so for 3 months, we would have to unlace him every day and go in so that he could heal from the inside out. And so we set up a sterile room, and we would have to sterilize everything and just give him all the morphine he could possibly take, and or put the lidocaine inside there and debride it. And finally one day it grew out. But before that, he was 3.5 years on the feeding tube. He couldn't eat anything. And we remember the day he ate a half of a green bean. And, you know, it was just such a joyous thing, because always before, anything that went in came back out. And so he had had a Nesson pontification where he can't throw up. But he would just be so, so sick if he tried to eat anything. And in the midst of him being so sick, his sed rate was so high that his legs bowed and he couldn't walk. So we went all the way back to a walker, and we had to learn to walk. He had to learn everything all over again because he was so, so, so bad. So we did, at that point in time, get a little bit of help. And he had for a few months, we had a few nurses that did get to come in and help us with that. And, of course, he had a PICC line. So it was like $10,000 for just a very short while, running all that stuff through the PICC line. You know, so it was, he's a multi-million-dollar kid, literally. And had it not been for the community coming together at that time to help raise funds, Pfeiffer College had two different plays that they put on, and Richfield Elementary had a penny drive, and the fire department had a hamburger dinner, and then they did a cookout. And he was the face of every little kid who everybody always or thought wouldn't make it, and he's still here. And he's said he just had his 40th surgery. He has one more coming up in July, and he will have to have a knee transplant sometime within the next few years, but we're going to push it as long as we can. But every time, he always comes through with a smile, just that huge smile. So
can you tell me about what made some of your experiences good experiences with healthcare providers throughout all of that?
We had some wonderful doctors, and when we first brought them back, Lanny and I were going to Richfield Family Physicians, and they actually had a place out here. Well, it's Mount Pleasant Family Physicians, but they had a place in Richfield. And Dr. Sexton was the doctor that we had been seeing, and Dr. Laura Pons was just finishing her internship, and she was starting to work with them. When he got so sick within just they were treating him, and he just started getting bad and worse, and it just started up one day. His knee just swelled really big, his right knee. When I went in the hospital every night, Dr. Pons would call me, and we would sit on the phone the majority of the night, knowing she had to work all day the next day. She would go over her computer looking for anything and everything that she could, and she would give me things that I should talk to the doctors about. And so when the doctors would come in the next day, I would talk to them, and then they would check things out because it really sounds right. And so they would go through it, and then again that night she would call me back as soon as she could, and we would start all over again if they hadn't come to a total conclusion. And so it's people like Dr. Pons. She is wonderful. She has moved on. She's working at the hospital up at Cabarrus, and which they're part of CMC now. But that was the only family doctor that he would even see. And he was failure to thrive, so he stayed. He was 24 and a half pounds when we adopted him at 4 and a half. And he was still 24 and a half pounds 2 years later. And so we just kept trying to... But Dr. Laura Pond, she's really, really a special friend. And so when she moved on to the hospital, which, I mean, that was an upgrade for her to get to work at the hospital instead of working in the clinic every day. And so Dr. Joshua Hall is now our regular family physician. But Logan actually, at this point in time, he has 14 different doctors that we see on a regular basis. And it's really crazy, because when he was at he was a Shriners kid, because with his legs being so bad, and he has a bone cyst in his left arm. They've actually done 5 surgeries, and we're getting ready to have the 6th surgery done on that in July, and they're going to be doing that, Dr. Pat over in Charlotte at CMC is going to be doing that. And of course, he just had his right knee done in Concord. And we get referred to some of the best doctors. Once in a while, you end up with one, but you know it almost immediately when you meet them, because if they don't, I guess you could say, fall for Logan's smile, then you know it's not going to be a good fit. And they're not really a good doctor, but he's really got some really good doctors at this time. He does have 2 different types of arthritis because of being sick for so long. His sed rate was so high, and it took us over 2 years to get his sed rate down to anywhere near normal. It should be 0 to 10, and his started out at 139. And the doctors, the first time they looked at it, they said, this is wrong. And so they checked it again, and it was 138. They sent it to an independent lab. It came back at 139. So he had some serious, serious inflammation. Every fiber of his body was full of inflammation. And we have no doubt, had we not adopted Logan, that he probably would not have lived another month or two, maybe, because he was so, so sick. And I actually had the opportunity to go back to Russia 5 years later on a mission trip, and we raised money to go back and help out the orphanages where we had adopted, Pansy and I did, where we adopted our kids, and to go back and just do things. We raised $26,000 and went back over there, and they were just... had come so far in that 5 years. And so instead of buying tires and dishes and the things like we had had to help buy before, we actually bought soccer balls and bicycles and just some of the fun things that kids like, and, you know, basketball goals. And it was really something. But when we went to Logan's orphanage and they said he really lived, they really didn't think when we brought him home that he would survive. And they were just so shocked and amazed. And his facilitator and his translator that helped us out with the adoption, they actually came to North Carolina from Russia, because it was during that time when people were having problems, that people were actually adopting kids and like taking a kidney and, you know, taking body parts and stuff like that. So when word got back at that time that he had had 20-some surgeries at that time, they actually had to come and see him for themselves to make sure that we weren't just taken piece by piece. And when they got here, where different people had brought toys and things for Logan and Christina, their rooms were just so full, and I had just shelving everywhere and baskets hanging everywhere. And when they walked in and looked at their rooms, they're like, oh my God, they live in toy stores. And they were just so amazed but so pleased with what was going on with him. Not him being sick, but the things that we were doing to help him through the problems. And it's been a long-term thing, and he will probably have to have different things, you know, ongoing for years to come. But every surgery's just put him a little closer to where he needed to be.
How do you think living in this community has impacted you as you've cared for a child with so many needs?
Everybody has been so supportive. And like the fire department, after they helped out and had a fundraiser and everything, then Lanny felt like he needed to do something to help pay back. So he joined the fire department. And for 8 years, he was in the fire department, and he goes, of course, on a lot of the calls, and he also became a medic working with them. He took all those classes. And then when Logan and Christina got old enough, when Logan turned 18, he talked to them and told them, even though Logan, he had to miss a lot of school. And then once he got in school, he was bullied in school. And so we actually pulled him out of school in the 8th grade and started homeschooling. And then we tried to put him back in, but he actually has PTSD from the bullying, and not just the kids. There were some of the teachers that were really, really so totally unreasonable to this child, to the point of one teacher in particular, when she was told to move him to the front of the class because they didn't want to go ahead and put glasses on him right now, but his eyes were going bad because he had had iritis and he was about to lose his eye. Instead of moving him to the front of the class, she put him in the back of the class, facing the exit door. And when I asked him, did the teacher move you today? And he said, yeah. And he was trying to explain to me where he was. And I'm saying, no, that can't be right. And he had a meltdown. And he had never done that before. And I actually took him to the doctor because he was just crying and carrying on so. And they actually had to give him something the first time ever for his nerves, because he was just so totally at wit's ends, because he knew, but he couldn't communicate well enough at that time to tell us exactly where he was and the way he was telling me. So he literally has PTSD from being bullied by not just the kids, but the kids and the teachers. Now, some of the teachers were great, don't get me wrong. But these few isolated teachers, and it does hurt. And it hurts them really, really bad. But some of his teachers are just totally wonderful. And they're the community. And as I started out before, that Lanny went and talked to them, and they actually let Logan join as a firefighter. So he gets to participate. No, he'll never run into the burning buildings, but he does have his suit. And he feels a part of the firefighters. And the majority of the firefighters, they just happen to go to Matins Grove United Methodist Church with us. So when the fire bell goes off or our pagers and phones go off, Logan gets to jump up with the rest of us. When Christine and I jump up and drop our robe from the choir, we run in the back room, drop our robe, and off we go. And because when she turned 18, then I joined. And so all four of us, we do it as a family unit. And it just gives us some way to pay back. Or, you know, you can never pay people back for the things that they did, because people were just so totally willing to do just anything and everything that they could. And while Logan was really, really sick, I ended up having to have a surgery. And they ended up cutting into my bladder, and I ended up with a huge infection, and I almost died. And so I had to have, I was in a wheelchair and had to use a breathing machine several times a day. Matins Grove, the people there brought two meals every day for 90 days. Every day. Most people just don't do that. But that's the community that we have. And that's why we go to Matins Grove, because they're just wonderful, wonderful people. And they try to help not only the people in our community, but they also help like with the Boy Scouts. And they just bought a couple goats for some kids over in Africa. So, you know, it's just, we don't just do one thing. We try to do lots of different things. And the Everharts as a family, we try to do everything that we can to try to help pay back. So when anybody's sick, we try to go and provide a meal when they'll let us, because we have certain days we send around a sheet and everybody just signs up, and then we just try to do everything we can to try to help out and to try to pay back and just do what we can.
Living here in this area, what has it been like to travel to Charlotte and other places for medical care?
Well, with Logan, in the beginning, he was in Charlotte, and then he was in UNC. So the first 2 months, I lived with him. I did not leave him. I didn't leave his room. And when we went to UNC, we got there in early August. The furthest I would get is I would walk across the hall where they had popsicles and things in the refrigerator, and so that he could try to eat a popsicle and different things like that. But I stayed right by him. Lanny stayed here. He took care of the company. He took care of Christina. And then when they could, they would try to run over and visit with him. And then when he got out from there, for several months, we had to go every day. We had to go back because he had so many different doctors, because he had problems with his eyes, he had problems with his ears, his sinuses, all of these things due to the inflammation, and which was building up to be the arthritis, but at that time it was just showing up as different things. At one point in time, he couldn't swallow. And so we would have to go over there for swallowing exercises, and they would have to actually put him in the x-ray machine and watch, as he tried to swallow. And so it was just, we just did what we had to do. And I had a little a little Kia van, because I got rid of my Nissan car. But I had a little Kia van where I could just strap him down, and we'd just ride along, and I'd have him looking up at the clouds and everything as we'd drive down the road, and him trying to talk to me and tell me what he saw. And I drove, and we just did what we had to do to get him past it. And then when he was through over there, and several years later, which he was so sick in the beginning that when our insurance wouldn't pay anymore and everything, we actually applied to Shriners because we had heard they were going to be taking care of the whole kid. But he was so sick, we actually have a letter where Shriners turned him down when they had never turned the kid down. Now, 4 years later, when he got the bone cyst, and the doctors that were working with his bone cyst did get in touch with Shriners, and they did accept him at that time. But the first time they said that he had too many different problems, and since they were trying to handle the whole child, that they actually couldn't take him, and they'd never really turned anybody down. But he was actually turned down because he was too sick. But like I said, they did come back 4 years later, and But when his bone cyst started, he actually broke his arm twice, and we had no idea, because with Logan having been born a 7.5-month baby, he was put in a laying down room. He was not expected to live. He was never bottle fed. He was, I'm sure they must have given him IVs. But one of the nurses or ladies that worked with him there told me that a couple times a day, and him a preemie, 7.5-month gestation, a couple times a day they would actually try to give him a little bit of broth, but that he couldn't suckle. And so I never realized that if a child never learns to suck, if they aren't breastfed or bottle fed, they don't learn how to chew. And so he actually had to have 3.5 years of chewing, eating, and speech, because the chewing, the eating, and the speech all has to do with the same muscles in the tongue. And to this day, he has to get up in the morning and wake his tongue up. So he has to do special exercises. Just a lee lee la 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 la, just almost like he's getting ready to sing opera. If he doesn't, he starts talking and you can't understand him. But then after he wakes his tongue up so it will move sufficiently, then you can understand him.
Wow, it sounds like you and your husband do a lot to take care of other people. Are there things that you do to take care of yourself?
I take care of them since I took cosmetology. I actually have always cut their hair. They've never gone to a barber shop or beauty shop. I did have Christina's hair washed one time at Walmart, and she was so amazed that you could lay back in a chair and have your hair washed. But it was the day that they had crazy hair day at school, and then we went to have a doctor's appointment, and she was so embarrassed being in Walmart with her crazy hair day. And when she cried, I took her in and let them wash her hair to wash the craziness out of her hair. But during Logan's problems, we actually had a small saltwater pool put in the backyard because he needed water therapy. And it was easier to do that than it was to take him on a daily basis. Plus the fact, if you take him other places and with all the different problems and surgeries, he could get all kinds of infections and different bacteria because he has a very low immune system from having all the problems he's had. So I get to exercise in the pool, and that's the one thing that I do for myself. And Lanny, he likes to go to his fire meetings and his medical meetings, and really, we get a lot of relaxation out of helping other people. So that's a lot of what we do, is that Christina and I sing in the choir, so we have our choir practice, and that is very relaxing to get away from home and to get there with the ladies from the church. And when we go on Monday nights, every other Monday night, we go to the fire station and have our fire meeting. And normally we'll go out and grab a bite to eat. And we do that as a family. And so that's just always something to look forward to. And really just watching them and watching the progress that he's made. And that's just a big benefit to me.
Well, thank you for sharing all that. In thinking about how long you've been in this area in Meisenheimer, I was wondering if you have any comments on how it's maybe changed over the years. Or stayed the same.
A lot of the people have stayed the same. You know, they build new houses. Our road used to be dirt. And they paved it just right after we adopted Logan and Christina. One of the main changes around here is every, it must be about every 20 years, they come through and cut almost all of the trees because of the tree farming thing and the people who planted trees, I guess, versus planting different vegetation or vegetables, whatever they were growing at the time. And so this past year, it seems like all of the trees around Stanley County and Rowan County, they're all cut down. And so it's so hot because you don't have the coolness of breeze blowing through the trees. But just mainly, it just stays a lot the same. We actually, when I had my dairy bar at Richfield, we actually had two gas stations and one bank. And now, which we still just have the one bank, but we've got about 11 different restaurants. And Bojangles, Kentucky Fried, Taco Bell, you know, just Wendy's, just about anything that you could want to eat, Subway, and a Food Line. So everything in Richfield has totally changed. But you still walk in and you see the people, and it's just like nothing ever changed.
What do you think is the best part about being from a small town or a rural community?
I think it's because you have so many people that are willing to help other people. I mean, it's like in our fire department. You know, nobody, we're volunteers, so nobody has to do anything. But when that pager goes off at 2 o'clock in the morning and somebody's having problems breathing, you're going to see about everybody in the fire department's going to show up. Or on Sunday when the preacher's getting ready to preach and everybody's there and they're running the audio and they're running the video in the church, and all of a sudden somebody else has to jump up if they're going to run the audio or the video, because the ones doing that are in the fire department. And so we all just have to take off and leave, because these people that we've depended on are dependent on us. And so it's just one of those things that there's just so many people out there that you can count on.
Do you think there are any challenges facing this community right now?
Well, not really many challenges, I don't think. It's just the people like me, we just keep getting older. And a lot of the older people are the ones who have been running the majority of a lot of the good things. And there's a lot of the younger ones that are not following suit. I think a lot of the younger ones tend to move away, which a lot of times, like myself, they come back. But it might take several years for them to decide to come back. And I think that's the biggest change is that you see, like I said, the people getting older. And some of the establishments that were there, you've got new people coming in because the older ones have passed or moved to Myrtle Beach.
And would you say this is a healthy community?
I'd say it is. We have, like every other community, it has some of its own problems. I mean, with the problems that they have now, you know, with drugs in the area, because the fire department were called out on a weekly basis, you're going to have several calls. You always hate to see that. But then on the other hand, it's just part of the world around us. And with us being right here at Pfeiffer College, it seems like the only bad things we used to have was somebody would come in and pull the fire alarm at 2 o'clock in the morning after everybody, they'd gone out drinking at some of the little establishments that were out there. But now it's not fire alarm. You end up with somebody that's done whatever, laying on the front lawn at Pfeiffer or out in front of one of the buildings somewhere. And we have to go out and rescue them. And that's just such a sad situation to see that happening. But then again, you know, you have all of the good things that's going on too. So you have to take the bad with the good.
If you could describe this community to somebody who's never been here before, what would you tell them about?
I would say that the majority of the community, and especially if they come to our church, to Matins Grove, has open arms, that they're willing to accept you as you are. They don't try to change you into somebody else. They're just willing to accept people into the area and, you know, bring you a basket by or bring you a few flowers or ask you if they can help you out in any way. So, you know, it's really a good little community to come to. And I've never regretted moving back, even though I did enjoy the South Pacific and I did enjoy Europe. And I love to travel. Christina and I just went on a cruise down to the Bahamas back in April and a year ago. But when I went on the cruise, Christina and I went with the choir ladies, and we actually took to preacher. So we were the choir ladies and the preacher on the cruise. And we had a blast. And we told everybody where we were from and that we were the choir ladies. And that was our preacher. And the year before that, I had taken my older daughter, Carrie, and we had gone on a cruise to the Bahamas also. And at that time, I actually took her with the choir ladies. And it was just really, we all had a good time. And we're planning on all going back next year. And we're hoping this time Carrie and Christina can go.
Well, thank you for sharing all the things that you've talked about this afternoon. Is there anything that I've left out asking about or anything else you'd like to share?
The one thing that we didn't get into, and I had mentioned to you before, was the accident that Lanny had back in 1984. That was the year just right after we had gotten married. And he actually had a truck that went off the mountain up in South Pittsburgh, Tennessee. And he had his right leg, the ball joint, was broken over 100 pieces. His left thumb came up through his hand. He had both shoulders, one fractured, the other was broken. And when they went to, they really thought he was going to die in South Pittsburgh, Tennessee. So I had him transferred to Winston-Salem Baptist. And Dr. Paling, whom had done knee surgery for me the year before, and he said he would take him on as a patient. And after staying up there for 24 hours and looking at him going into renal shutdown, and he was dying. And so I called the bank and told the bank that I needed some money, and they had the deed to my house. And they told me to write the checks. And that's what small towns are all about. And that was with the Bank of Stanley when they were in Albemarle. And so I had to rent doctors, nurses, helicopters, a jet. And we got him and ambulances. And against the wishes of the doctors at South Pittsburgh, Tennessee, those doctors pulled him out for me, and we got him to Winston Baptist, and they had three teams of surgeons waiting. And Dr. Paling was waiting at the door when we brought him in from the helipad, and I had to sign a paper, and they took him directly in for surgery. And I signed a paper stating that I knew that they were going to put glue inside his body, and that had never been done before. So he is affectionately known as the Glue Man. because they had only done glue inside the body of cadavers before that. His knee, they actually took his left hip, and so that meant that he had nothing that moved at all for months and months. But they took his left hip and used it as pieces to refashion his leg to go into the right knee and put his leg back together. And he actually walks. I mean, he's literally a miracle. He walks without a limp. But when I signed the paper, he was either going to come out without a leg, with a stiff leg, or with a movable leg. And he can run. So Dr. Paling did a fabulous job. And as a matter of fact, a couple months ago, I had to go to the doctor and have a cortisone shot put in my knee, where they had done my surgery on my knee. And as I was talking to the doctor, and he asked me who done my arthroscopic surgery, and I said, Dr. Paling. And he said, oh my God, he is my nemesis. And I am going to see him in November. They're having a big party there, and he's having the party. And he said, he's just wonderful. And I said, well, he did my husband's knee. And he said, well, oh, he had arthroscopic surgery. I said, no, he glued his knee back together, and he was the first person. He goes, my God, your husband is the glue man. And I said, well, yes, I guess. He said, oh, my God, do you know how many times I've heard about the glue man? I've got to meet this man. He says, will you bring your husband over here? And I will give him, I will check him, I will check his, I'll check him all over and give him the results, and I will not charge him a penny if he will please, please come and do that so that I can tell Dr. Paling I saw the glue man. And so I said, well, I'm sure he probably would. So I called him. He said, yeah, if they'll give me the results. So he told me he would put my shots in my knee the next day if I brought my husband back. So I brought my husband back. So Lanny walked in with me, and I got up and I sat down on the table, and my doctor came in, and he said, would you mind sitting over here a little bit? He says, I've got to talk to your husband for a little bit. And so I sat there, and he talked, and he worked, and he checked his knee, and he x-rayed him, and he did all kinds of papers on him, and I'm sitting there in the corner with my hand raised, and I have pain here. And it's okay. He had the glue man. So when he finally got through, and he then finally put the shots in my knee and told me how absolutely amazed he was to meet the glue man. And when Lanny asked him, he said, well, just how wonderful am I doing? And he said, well, the only problem is, he said, I think the nerves must have died in and around because of all the trauma. And most people with the condition of your leg would come in the door in a wheelchair screaming for pain meds. And he said, but you seem to be doing fine. And Lanny said, yes, I was doing fine until you told me that. He says, and now I might have to rethink my situation. And he said, nah, I think you're going to be just fine. So the orthopedic doctor got to go see Dr. Paling and regale to him about the glue man. And Lanny got to find out that his knee's not as great as he thought it was, but he doesn't even walk with a limp. And for a guy who was possibly going to lose the leg or, you know, come out with it stiff, he does great.
How did you know to take him, to get him to Wake Forest Baptist rather than keep him in Tennessee?
When the doctor came in and looked at him, and I had looked at the x-rays, and the x-rays, it didn't look like a knee. It just looked like a bunch of, like a vase, and you'd crushed it and just piled it up. And I asked him, I said, now you're an orthopedic doctor. He says, yes, my name is Dr. Bone. I said, oh, is that your nickname? He says, no, I had the name, so I took the profession. And I started getting weak-kneed. And literally, when the lights went low that night, and they had just decided that it was a good thing in the medical industry at that time not to give somebody with real bad trauma a lot of pain medication. They were using electric shock. So they had put a machine on his leg that was just shocking him. And so he was dying. I mean, he was going into renal failure. His heart was starting to act up. He'd never had heart problems. His blood pressure, everything was going crazy. And I knew Dr. Paling was so great when he done my knee and the arthroscopic surgery. And I was just so happy with everybody I had talked to over there. My father, having been in a welder, he had two bad accidents at different times, and we had had him transferred back to Winston Baptist. And both times they saved his life. And so I thought, you know what? If I can get him to Winston Baptist, I knew Dr. Paling was on the leading end of so much discovery on knees, or just bones in particular. And I really felt if I could get through to him that he would take him. And the hospital at South Pittsburgh, they're like, no, you move him, he's going to die. And I knew I had to do everything I could. And so when I called and told them, hey, you've got the title to the house, I just need money. And so they said, go ahead. And so I did what I had to do. I got in touch with Dr. Paling. He returned my call. He said, you get him here, we'll be waiting. And we got him there. And they did a phenomenal job. And Winston Baptist, they just, to this day, I would recommend anybody. I mean, I know CMC has grown and has gotten so big, and they are leaders in so many things, but, and which Dr. Paling, I'm not sure if he's even teaching at Winston Baptist, but I think he owns a lot of the different things there at Winston Baptist, because he's just made so much progress in the industry of working on the bones. And so he came through. He did a fabulous job. And
well, thank you so much for adding in that story. Is there anything else you'd like to share?
I think I've just about touched on everything.
Well, thank you. It's been such an honor to sit here and hear your story. So thank you for sharing that.
Oh, you're welcome.